Well, thanks to the organizers for asking me to speak at this meeting. So let me start out with just some general motivation. This is not a space-time diagram. I apologize for that, but I'm very quickly going to move past this. Almost. But I very soon you'll be very comfortable. Anyway, so this is a phase diagram of some complicated material known as a high-temperature superconductor. And one long-standing problem for many years has been understanding what's called the strange metal phase here. And so that's you can think of it as a quantum state, which doesn't behave like an ordinary metal like copper or gold, in the sense that it cannot be described by motion of individual particles. But it's still a metal. It can exist at various different densities. And there's a long-standing open problem on how you formulate the theory of the transport and various other properties of these exotic type metallic states. Now, one interesting, very exotic state from the point of view of solid-state physics is a conformal field theory. A conformal field theory is an example of a quantum state that doesn't have sharp quasi-particle excitations, for which you can't apply things like the Boltzmann equation. But a conformal field theory invariably only exists at a very specific density, and it's what we call commensurate and particle hole symmetric. And so that's introduces many different artifacts. So we really want examples which are not conformal field theories. That's really the with fermions and variable density. Okay. So now we're in more familiar ground. So let me just review some basic aspects of conformal field theory and gauge gravity duality. So of course, the most famous example is the ADS-CFT correspondence, where you have a duality between, say, Einstein gravity for simplicity in d plus two dimensional space-time with a conformal field theory in d plus one dimensional space-time. And so this is the zero temperature correspondence we believe exists between two very different theories. I'm here going to focus on just basically one quantity, which is the entropy. Or the entropy per unit area, if I'm considering an infinite system here. Then at finite temperature, what happens in the context also of Einstein gravity is that on the gravity side, you get a horizon at a distance r, and r is related to the inverse temperature. So the lower your temperature, the farther out this horizon is. And then there's two ways of thinking about the entropy density of the system. One way is to use the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, which is the area of the horizon. And that gives you an entropy density that goes as T to the D. And this at least scales as T to the little d, where D is the spatial dimension here, space. That's little d is always be the number of spatial dimensions. And this you can kind of see from just this factor of 1 over r squared in the spatial direction. That means each spatial length goes as 1 over r. And since r becomes capital R and capital R goes as 1 over t, there's your factor of t to the d. So that's it just comes from the metric, and that gives you this Bekenstein-Hawking t to the d. So it vanishes at zero temperature. Similar, and of course, that's exactly the behavior of a conformal field theory, where you can use scaling arguments. The entropy density is just a density estimate, and all densities will just go as t to the d. But if you want to do better and actually get the numbers out front, well, that's really quite difficult in general. Even the most famous example of the Super Yang-Mills theory, where using the ADS-5 S5 geometry in the bulk, we know exactly what the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy answer is. It goes as t cubed, as you would expect from the general argument. And then there's this complicated, well, in this case, very simple numerical coefficient of pi squared over 2 that comes from the full structure of the gravity theory. Unfortunately, it's somewhat surprising. I was just digging into this. This particular number has never been checked. From the field theory side, from a computation on the boundary theory, we still don't know, although almost everyone believes, I'm sure, it's correct. But there's no independent verification of this particular number from a field theory computation yet. I think for the entanglement entropy, there are checks from two sides now. Okay, Another case which has been in some sense checked, but also there's a little, but it is our conformal field theory is in one dimension, where the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy gives you exactly the same formula that you get from conformal field theory, from just where we know by conformal mapping what the entropy density is. And you can relate the central charge in that case to Newton's constant and by many different ways, and it all hangs together. Although this is, again, a derivation which doesn't explicitly identify what the degrees of freedom are on the boundary. It's just CFTs in 1 plus 1 dimension are simple enough that just knowing the central charge gives you the entropy, but that generically not can't do that in higher dimensions. Okay. Whoops. okay. All right, well, let me keep going. I know I can. Okay, so now what I want to talk about are systems that are not conformal field theory, as I said in the beginning. And one of the simplest ways to go away from a conformal field theory with the Einstein action is to add a global U1 charge in the conformal field theory. So in the dual theory, you have a U1 gauge flux that you have to consider, so you add a Maxwell term. So now we're just going to consider in the remainder of this discussion the Einstein-Maxwell theory. And then once you have a global U1 charge, you take your conformal field theory and smear some density Q off this charge associated with F. So now you just have to solve the Einstein-Maxwell equations in this sort of configuration and as a result, of course, by Gauss's law, you get an electric flux in the bulk, and that changes the structure of the bulk spacetime. And the solution, as I'm sure many of you know, is called the ADS-Reisner-Nordström solution, and it has the property that it exists for any value of the charge density Q. And as I'll discuss more detail, there's also a horizon then, which then exists, in fact, down the way all the way to zero temperature. So if I just take this as a definition of a quantum theory, here's a gravitational theory, then on the boundary I have a very interesting type of state. It's a state that has an unbroken global U1 symmetry with a continuously variable charge density Q, and this solution can also exist at zero temperature. And also you can quickly check by the usual ADS-CFT rules that boundary correlators don't have any free particle-like dispersion. So by definition, in some sense, that's a strange metal. So if you ask, you know, it's kind of surprising how difficult it is to satisfy these criteria, that you take any quantum theory, let's say translationally invariant for now, which has a global U1 charge, and at zero temperature, you want the freedom to be able to vary the value of the global U1 charge continuously. There's only very, very few states you can do that. You can do that with free fermions, as in a Fermi liquid. You can do it in a superfluid, but a superfluid breaks the global U1 symmetry. Or you can do it in a solid, but a solid also breaks translational symmetry and has quasi-particle phonon type modes and so on. So if you exclude those well-known possibilities, there's really nothing else except strange metals that we're trying to understand. So that's what's kind of so interesting about the solution. It gives you very easily a kind of state that's very difficult to obtain by field theory methods.
Why does a strange metal have a continuously variable charge?
That's my definition, if you wish. That's how I'm defining a strange metal. It's any quantum state with a continuously variable density which doesn't have quasi-particles, roughly.
And that's a feature of these superconductors?
Yes, that's a feature of all of these strange metal states. It's right.
You're not worried that you have more microscopic processes than the condensation of scalars?
Well, but then I wouldn't call that a metal. If a scalar condenses, then it becomes a superfluid. It would have very different properties.
I know. No.
That's a good worry. In fact, almost all models do that.
This is
one of the reasons this is hard to study. okay.
Is there actually a known model that doesn't do it?
Yes, there are somewhat.
When you say that does not have any quasi-particles, does that mean the low-lying excitations are all neutral?
No, they're going to be charged excitations. Yeah. So they're just not sharp. They don't have long lifetimes.
They just draw a continuum. There's no delta function fits in any limit. Okay. So that's, you know, a very interesting thing. So the, whatever this solution is an AD's Rankine Norton solution. It describes a state of matter. I mean, a long-standing problem has been to understand what that matter state is.
Okay. So now let me, I'm just going to do pure gravity for the next few slides. Let me just review some properties of this Rankine Norton solution that I'm going to need in this shortly. So one universal property of these solutions is that if you go very near the horizon, the near horizon metric is ADS2. And I'm just going to largely ignore that extra factor, which is the R to the D in the case that I've drawn here. And in addition to having this ADS2 metric, you also have an electric field, which in this particular coordinate frame, I'll write this way. And E is what I'm going to call the electric field. And you can actually see from the way I've defined it that E is a dimensionless number. Okay, so that's a feature of all of these solutions of any charged black hole and actually almost any theory of gravity has a near horizon metric, which is ADS2. Okay, and another consequence of this this form of the metric or an extremal horizon is that as temperature goes to zero, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy doesn't go to zero. It goes to a non-zero value, unlike the case for a conformal field theory. So that's a very surprising property from the point of view of a strange metal. Many would say this is, disqualifies this from being a strange metal because experimentally this is never true. But let's just keep going anyway. Okay, so in the context of the gravitational theory, you can then determine this number E and also this the value of this zero temperature entropy as a function of the charge density Q. And of course, as Q goes to zero, these will go to zero in some complicated way. They'll depend on the full gravity theory, and you'll reach a conformal field theory. Another thing I want to now also remind you that this you can also think of this as a system in a chemical potential, which is conjugate to the density Q. And that chemical potential is the value of the vector potential A near this boundary. Okay. All right. So now I'm going to take this geometry and take it to a low temperature, small temperature, for a reason that will become clear in a minute. So that can be done, again, because of the ADS2 structure by a conformal map. And this, so again, there's a universal structure of what happens at finite temperature. Basically, the horizon moves from here to in this coordinate zeta to some other coordinate at zeta naught. And zeta naught in this coordinate frame where the zero temperature horizon was at zeta equals infinity is 1 over 2 pi t. All right. Okay, so now what I want to figure out really is how, you know, how this these horizons move as I change the charge density Q, and how does the entropy change as I change the charge density Q. Now, in the bulk, there's no charges. The charges are really only on the boundary. So Gauss's law tells me very simply that right on the boundary, A must be equal to chemical potential, and that could depend on temperature. If I keep the charge density fixed. But whatever is here must be some function of R because the divergence of the electric field has to be zero, and then you integrate that. So it must have this form where there's no temperature dependence here. It's all just in the boundary value. So that's actually the key step that allows me to prove an important identity just using Gauss's law, again, very generically valid. And what that tells me then, if I compare this form of A, which is valid everywhere, with the form of A right near the boundary, which has a temperature dependent path, which is exactly 2 pi t times E, so that tells me that mu of t as t goes to 0 is some constant that depends on the charge density minus 2 pi E t. Okay. All right, so sorry for this very, so that's the most complicated algebra you have to do. Just use Gauss's law and include this. And now you use a very beautiful relation called the thermodynamic Maxwell relation, which is very natural to imagine is obeyed by a thermodynamic system, but also, as Hawking and others showed, is also obeyed by Einstein's equation. And this relation right here. So this follows from the fact that it's an example of a Maxwell relation where if you have a free energy, then we know the entropy is minus df dt. And the chemical potential is df dq. So if you use these facts, and then that tells me that ds dq is d mu dt, if you remember your Maxwell relation. And you can check that actually Einstein's as Hawking and others showed, also obey this equation. So therefore, I get this important relation that the derivative of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy with respect to the density q is equal to d mu minus d mu dt, which is 2 pi e. So that's the main relation I want to focus on that tells me how the zero temperature entropy changes as I change the charge density q, and it changes by this electric field. The derivative is 2 pi times the electric field. And actually, this relationship goes back to work of Ashok Sen, who also showed it holds even in higher derivative gravity. It's a very general type of relation, as this derivation also makes clear. Okay, so this is the one thing I want you to remember, a general property of charged black holes in almost all theories of gravity. Okay, so now I'm going to do a little bit of quantum mechanics. I'm going to imagine I have a Dirac fermion moving in this charged black hole background. And this was worked out by the MIT group a few years ago. And among other things, they showed that if you look at the Green's function of this psi right on the boundary, it had some power law behavior, say, in frequency. So this delta is some scaling dimension that depends on the mass, the bulk mass, as usual, in usual ADS-CFT. But there's an asymmetry between positive and negative frequencies. So that's something very, very non-CFT-like. A positive and negative frequencies are behaving differently. But when you have a finite charge density, you know, the act of adding a particle and removing a particle are very different processes, because there's a background density which is either particles or holes. So adding a particle, say, is positive frequencies, removing a particle is negative frequencies, they're not the same. And that asymmetry is specified by this electric field E. Okay. So that's another way to think of E. The electric field E is what encodes the particle hole symmetry of the quantum matter that you're studying. And that quantum matter certainly has very strange metal-like Green's functions. Okay, and now you can also, as these people did, you can extend this to finite temperature, and it has these gamma function forms. Everything is fully specified by delta and E. Okay, so that's ends my review of charged black holes in classical gravity and semi-classical gravity, where you use the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy formula and also just the propagation of a fermion in the background. All right, so this raises the question: what does this represent? Can you write down some model which has all these properties? And you know, since these results are very general, they apply to many different theories of gravity. So maybe there's many different models. And if you're really ambitious, we want a one-to-one correspondence. But let's right now be a little less ambitious. Some class of models that look like this class of gravity theories. So a few years ago, I had conjectured that this old model I looked at way back in 93 may be the answer, because it seemed to match many of the properties. Today, I want to describe a little more detail and give you some further evidence that, in fact, this conjecture is correct. Okay, so this was the model we worked on in 93. All right, so yeah, so now we're in a very different playing field. Our actors are fermions, C, canonical fermions, sitting on some lattice sites, I. And they also carry this additional flavor index, alpha, which runs from 1 through M. And the site index runs from 1 through N. And there's some four-fermion interaction, which you can sort of see is a kind of an exchange interaction in the flavor space. Okay. And then there's a coupling between all of these. This exchange interaction Jij is just a Gaussian, is just a random variable. Okay, I'm not going. I just put this up because this is the model we studied. It has some difficulties in the sense that you have to take a very careful limit as n goes to infinity and m goes to infinity to obtain a strange metal, because if you fix m equals 2, then you get something else, a spin glass state, which is another interesting state, but it's kind of a classical state. It's not really a quantum liquid of any kind. But recently, there was a suggestion by Kitaev to generalize this model slightly. And that makes it much easier to study, at least numerically. But I want to emphasize that everything I'm going to say from now applies without any change to both models. But let me describe this model, because it's slightly easier to describe to a non-condensed matter audience. So here, I just have canonical fermions on sites I and J and K, n sites. There's no spatial structure. These are just every site is connected to every other site. And fermions are hopping between these sites. And the most important feature, just like here too, is that the fermions can only move in pairs. So if a fermion here wants to move to some other site there, it has to partner up with some other fermion that together move. So in some sense, motion can only occur via entanglement. So there's no motion unless there's entanglement. And that's the key feature of this model. And they also have to be fermions. If these were bosons, it'd probably be a spin glass. So it'll freeze into some random state. But fermions can't freeze, basically because they anti-commute with each other. So this is the model we want to study, where the J, I, J, K, L are just random numbers. So there's more random numbers here than there, and that also aids the numerical analysis. But in the end, the state is exactly the same. Okay. So this model has a global U1. So that's actually the feature of the model in this recent paper. Q, which commutes with the Hamiltonian. And we can find a solution as n goes to infinity. It's an exact solution at n goes to infinity. It's a partial exact solution anyway, with any value of Q between 0 and 1. Obviously, Q cannot go beyond that limit. All right, so what are some of the properties of this solution? Yeah.
Normalize it by n to the 3 counts?
Just to get an energy density of order 1. I mean, so that's, you can see it from perturbation theory. So the way, okay, that's actually a good point too. So how would I analyze this model? You have a 4 fermion interaction, J, with lines I, J, K, L. So if you just start with the bare graph, then the first graph would be something like this. Okay, so this graph, when you average over J, so J average is 0, so this whole graph is just 0. So that doesn't do anything. That's actually the key reason you need this random numbers to make this go to 0. So then at next order, you're going to get graphs like this. And in the end, there's only one graph that matters, which is this graph. All of the graphs are either subgraphs of this, exactly of this type, or they vanish as n goes to infinity. This is the only graph that matters. So what happens here is you've got J, and once you do the average, so if there was an I here and I prime here, once you do the average over J, you want to pick the term where I equals I prime. So you can just drop the I prime here. Then there's a J here and a K here. So this graph will give you J squared. And there's one, and then J squared over N cubed, which is the N 3 halves there. And then you sum over J, I, J, K, these internal lines, you sum over all sites. That gives you another factor of N cubed. And this is the only graph which remains of order 1. Everything else doesn't matter. Of course, you can put this inside as a subgraph, but that's about all you can do. So that's basically the solution of the model. And what I just showed you leads to these equations. So these are very simple looking equations, but we're still discovering new structure in these 3 equations. That's the complete solution, even at finite temperature as n goes to infinity. So your Green's function, is given by some self energy sigma of omega, and then the self energy is g squared of tau times g squared of minus tau. So the self energy is this graph right here. There's g, g, and g of minus tau. Graph is exactly that. And then there's a constraint that the number of particles is Q. And in fact, this model is self-averaging. So you don't even, in principle, if n is large enough, you just need one sample. Every site will look the same. And only the on-site Green's function is appreciable in that limit. OK, so then it's just a matter of solving these equations, which is, it's easier said than done. But we're learning more about the structure of the solution of these equations. Okay, so one of the things you learn by just staring at this at a while and argued a long time ago the solution, in fact, is looks like a strange metal. If you want a solution at any density Q, the real part of the self-energy must cancel this mu, and then there's a singularity, and then the Green's function has this 1 over square root of omega branch cut at zero frequency. Okay. So what you see from here is that the self-energy has a part that cancels this. So let's get rid of that and define sigma tilde, and sigma tilde then will go as square root of z. So that's the singular of sigma tilde, if you wish, the singular part of the self-energy. Then I can rewrite these equations in the following form. This is just Dyson's equation. It's different from the usual Dyson's equation because now I've thrown out, this is the key thing, I've thrown out this omega term. That's just the bare kinetic energy, if you wish. That doesn't matter because this sigma goes as square root of omega, which is bigger than that. So you can throw both of these terms out, and Dyson's equation is simply g sigma equals 1, and the self-energy equation is sigma is equal to g cubed. And these equations, now you can see, are invariant under a very large set of transformations. They're invariant under reparameterization invariance and also gauge invariance. So there's an emergent gauge symmetry and an emergent conformal symmetry. And so now you can see that's starting to look like gravity because there also the bulk has all this reparameterization invariance and also gauge invariance. Okay. One other thing worth pointing out here, as you'll see in a minute why, these equations have a very similar structure to other similar problems, and the problems are these Kondo-type problems. So in a Kondo-type problem, what you have is you have space in this direction and time in this direction. And then here's a CFT2 of the type that you know and love, but the CFT2 ends at one point. So there's a boundary of space, there's nothing here. And on this boundary, moving in time, you have some spin. Some spin is oscillating or a fermion or something. So that's how you write a Kondo problem. It's a CFT with some boundary degree of freedom. Now, if you you can also analyze these problems in some larger limit, and you get equations that look very similar to these equations. And the relationship between them is the following. You know, here I have this. Every fermion, every site, if you wish, is interacting with some environment. So and in the end, I'm focusing on this Green's function on a single site. So I have a fermion on a single site, it's doing its dance, and it's interacting with the environment of all the other fermions. So that respect is similar here. Here's the fermion I focused on, and then there's some environment. The difference here, here the environment is just like the fermion I focused on. There's a self-consistency condition, there's no independent CFT2. The CFT2 is made up of the same guys. So that makes the problem a little more complicated, but has some similarity. And you'll see why I mentioned that in a minute. Okay, so now you can, with this all this information, you can go ahead and solve these equations at finite temperature. And lo and behold, you get exactly the same functions that I showed you from a few slides back from this paper of Faulkner et al. Exactly the same function, with a further bonus, this delta is not free, the delta in this case, and this same relation between E and delta and all of that, because it just follows from conformal invariance, and delta is 1/4. I should have written that somewhere. Okay. You also get this additional relation between Q and E, between the charge density and this particle hole symmetry E. Okay. So finally then, I have to think about the entropy. What is the entropy of this model? Well, this model also turns out to have a zero temperature entropy. And that entropy is very closely related to the boundary entropy of the Kondo problem. So here we know, as Affleck, Ludwig, and others pointed out, that if you have a spin at the boundary of a CFT2, there's some number of order one, which is the zero temperature limit of the entropy associated with the boundary. Now what's happened here is that every point, every site I is both a boundary of every other site and part of the boundary of the other site. So you get the same number, if you wish, for every site. Anyway, so you can take these equations and play with them and analyze them. And this was actually done in various contexts by originally by Parkole-George and these people for the Kondo problem, and in this paper for this model. And when the dust settles, you get exactly this relationship between the derivative of the entropy density over the charge is equal to 2 pi e, where e is defined as the quantity that appears in this Green's function in this model, or in ADS2 is the electric field. So that's the basic result, that this very different looking model of just fermions with which can only move via entanglement, so it's kind of a very entangled system, has not a ground state degeneracy, I should say, a finite zero temperature entropy, which is not precisely the same thing. And it obeys exactly the same relation as comes out of gravity. This relates precisely the same relation that comes from solving classical equations of motion of charged black holes. What is different between the two models is this equation of state. So this relationship between Q and E, here is the relation which you can determine for this model. How much does the charge density, what kind of particle hole asymmetry does the charge density Q induce? In this case here, that's the question of when you put a charge density Q here, what electric field do you get on the horizon? So that depends on really going all the way from the bulk, from the boundary to the horizon, and depending on what theory of gravity you have, you can have different equations of state. So precisely exactly which theory of gravity I need here to reproduce this equation, this particular equation, I don't know. But no matter what, I know very generally in both sides that this relation holds. ds dq is 2 pi e. Okay, so that's really all I have to say. So here's, I'll just repeat everything I said in a very quick manner. So this is the model. This is the boundary model where fermions can move in pairs on any four sites. This has this asymmetric particle hole density of states, asymmetric density of states determined by the number e. This is the equation of state, and ds dq is 2 pi e. On this side, you have Einstein-Maxwell, or in fact, even higher derivative theories that give you charged black brains with a charge density q on the boundary and electric field e here. And they have exact, and you, of course, choose, you define e. I mean, you can view this as the definition of e on both sides. And you define it in exactly the same way by identifying this bulk Dirac fermion with this fermion C here. And then once you define it this way, then there's no ambiguity on either side on what S is and what Q is. You just go ahead and compute it, that's the equation of state, and you get, for the Bekenstein-Hawking value, exactly the same relation. So this is some evidence, I would say, that ADS2 gravity is really a description of models of this type. Thanks. Yes.
Okay, so I have to confess, completely confused by the picture on the left.
On the left,
there's nothing local about the model.
That's correct.
Correct.
Correct. Correct.
Nevertheless, the excitations, even though they're not quasi-particles, if I bang the thing in some place, won't it sort of spread out?
Well, there's no space, right? That you can't. It will just go to all of the sites, of course. So I think
will it propagate? I guess that's what I'm asking.
There is no space, so I don't even know
what you mean. There's no space. We're talking about a strange metal.
You propagate in the new direction.
All right. They're very good questions. So what you should view this thing as a mean field model. It's a mean field model which doesn't have space at all. It's just completely local. And that's also true. So this factorization here, that the fact that the geometry factorized, so at every point in RD, there is some quantum mechanical system. What I'm trying to describe by this full model here, this is, you think of this as a matrix. It's a matrix on Fock space. This matrix on Fock space is independently describing every point on RD. But I need the RD to normalize the density in some reasonable, that's the only, the RD or the SD or whatever else you want to put in.
So you're just capturing maybe the homogeneous properties of the state.
That's right.
So what would you do, let me change the question,
yes,
to capture the propagating properties?
Well, I would say that both models are then artifacts. I mean, I would say that on both sides, on this side, I don't think a realistic strange metal has no space. So that'll be a more complicated model, but you have to study it much, much harder. Similarly, on the right-hand side, I would guess that this ADS2, this factorization, is an artifact either of supersymmetry or of classical gravity, that if you really solve the full quantum gravity, there is no factorization.
We shall ask the same question.
Yes.
Like, there should be a correlation function in time.
Yeah.
Because there is no space. There should be a two-point function in time which corresponds to you shooting in something and do the geodesic in ADS2.
This doesn't have any space at all. So on the right hand side, you can compute such things, and that's what actually Faulkner et al. Computed some of that. There's no analog of that here. This is only giving you the local part. So, in other words, yeah.
No, but even at some fixed value of x, you could do what he's saying. Right?
Yes,
There probably is some kind of gravity, some kind of dilaton fluctuation just within ADS2. And there should be a field corresponding to that here. Yes, I agree. And I think Alexei Kiteyev apparently has some answers to that particular question, but we'll have to wait for his paper.
You have the fermion. And it
I have the fermion, but I don't have the scalar.
No, you don't have the scalar.
Timing the boundary.
But doesn't the fermion provide an example?
But there's more on both sides.
Sure.
So in some sense, we've just got the... This is a CFT on 0 plus 1 dimension in some sense. I wouldn't call it that. I don't quite know what to call it because people do talk about ADS2 CFT1 correspondence, and I'm not sure what that means. This theory is not quite a CFT, and it's not quite a boundary theory. It is what it is. It does have these symmetries that I wrote down. And there's some spectrum of operators, spectrum of scaling dimensions, and as usual, there'll be correspondence on both sides. And right now, all that I have shown you my match is the simplest fermion operator and the entropy, which match very well. Now, once I knew all the operators, presumably I'll know the full theory of gravity here. Not is it just Einstein Maxwell or is it something else? That's a very hard problem, but I think at least maybe it'll be solved eventually. Yeah.
So a very naive question. On the black hole side, equal to zero is an extremal black hole and
correct.
It has area. But for a real system, how does a T equal to zero system have disorder? I mean, entropies and
That's a very good question. I mean, here's the Hamiltonian. This is it, as I like to say. I just give this piece of paper to a mathematician. I don't need to say anything else. This defines everything. These are some operators that anti-commute. J is a random number. You tell me what happens. That's the complete definition of the model. And this model has the property which I claim, that if you compute the entropy per site at finite temperature and take the zero temperature limit, the one important thing is you've got to take the n goes to infinity limit before you take the zero temperature limit. So you take really many, many, many sites, and then you go to low temperature.
So at finite n, it doesn't have a degeneracy.
It doesn't have a degeneracy at finite n. Yeah, it's only at the order of limits of the finite temperature entropy where you send n to infinity first and then temperature to zero. In that limit, there is a ground. It violates the third law of thermodynamics, if you wish. And in fact, this was the reason between 2001 and now, I just forgot about this model. It just seemed ridiculous. At least I agree. But I think there's something deep here, and there's some very interesting structure here, which we haven't fully understood.
Can it be realized in an experiment, this n tending to infinity?
Well, I'll give you the standard answer of any person doing this in this field. Somebody will build a Cole-Adam system which will realize it. It could be. I'm serious, actually. I hope, yes.
Right. So do you understand right that randomness is only needed to kill this one diagram there? Is there an alternative way of killing such a diagram without randomness?
Some high degree of frustration may be enough. Really, the randomness is there, that's right, to kill the kind of tadpole corrections, which in a more physical way are ruling out some ordered state. I mean, there may be some regular state, where all the fermions go into some symmetric combination of orbitals or something. You want to rule out some boring state. Sufficiently frustrated may well have these same properties. Yeah. So in fact, you take a since you're, I mean, if you know DMFT, there's a, you can take DMFT on the beta lattice. You can define the same model on a beta lattice with infinite coordination, you get the same equations. So even those models there, in some sense, the beta lattice is also forbid, you know, somehow giving you ruling out more trivial type states. The most important property is the frustration and the absence of one-body hopping. Once you have one-body hopping, then you get a conventional metal. You get a Fermi liquid. But if you can only move by entangling another electron, then all kinds of interesting things can happen. I mean, we understand very little about such models. And this is the one solvable one.
OK, let's thank Subir again.